ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and this is Andy Irvine.
I appear out of a TARDIS at precisely as the clock strikes 9 o'clock and sing in weird tongues.
We're listening to Planxty, and that was the sound of Andy Irvine, founder of Planxty, talking to my predecessor on The Music Show, Christopher Lawrence, back in 1993. So Andy has been coming on The Music Show longer than I've been here. This year on the show, we thought we would have some big conversations with some of our most long-running regular guests, looking back on music, music now and music then. And if you've missed his many appearances on The Music Show, Andy's been a cornerstone of Irish music since the late 1960s, a former of bands like Planxty, a singer of traditional songs and new songs, some of them by Andy himself, and a virtuoso of many instruments. He was an early adopter of the bouzouki, but he also plays the mandolin and the mandola, sometimes even the guitar, and the harmonica, and occasionally the hurdy-gurdy. Here's a little more of what Andy had to say back in 1993.
I've obviously always been susceptible to heroes and heroines. You know, I used to write songs about how heartbroken I was because I was continuously falling in love with people who didn't fall in love with me. So I'd always get a song out of that. And well, I matured a little bit and I thought, well, you can't go on writing this stuff. And I started writing songs about people that had impressed me, especially in the kind of socio-political field. And that's what I do. Like, a lot of my songs have a historical background. And I think that is, it's easier to write a song about somebody on whom the dossier has been closed because you've got all the information.
Yeah, to get it right.
And of course, I also consider that a lot of these people who are not remembered as well as they should be deserve to be, you know, a lot of these people have no place in history books. Social history does not occur in history books. And I just like to kind of try and redress the balance.
That chronicling of historical characters in his songs has been a constant theme of our conversations with Andy Irvine over the years. And so has the changing nature of Irish music, Celtic, Gaelic, folk, trad. The language for it changes as the conversations themselves evolve. When Andy was in Sydney last month, The Music Show asked if he'd like to have one of these long conversations in front of an audience of session goers at the Gaelic Club in Sydney. We climbed a staggering number of stairs in sweltering heat to the little wood panel bar, and Andy and I sat in front of a gaggle of people with fiddles and guitar cases at their sides, and he began by playing and singing one of his historical figure songs.
That's the chord I want, yeah. I beg your pardon, I'm kind of nervous where I really shouldn't be, but I am.
Harry Houdini, the handcuff king, he could escape from nearly anything. The world's admiration, Harry Houdini won it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. Harry Houdini, Hungarian born, taking the whole wide world by storm, getting out of straitjackets and walking through walls. Houdini could do it if it could be done at all. He took 27 needles and he swallowed them clean. We examined his mouth, not a needle to be seen. Then he swallowed cotton thread, what a magical blend. The needles came out threaded when he pulled on the end. Locked and chained in a casket underwater, holding his breath much longer than he ought to, accepting every challenge, and he never would shun it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. Jumping off a bridge with a big ball and chain, manacled and shackled, sure the man's insane. 10 minutes passed and we thought he must have died. When he came to the surface, it's magic, we cried. 40,000 people witnessed the affair. We cheered, shook hands and threw our hats in the air. And everybody wondered just how he'd overcome it. But if it could be done, Houdini done it. Locked and chained on a big wheel rotating, the buzz of the crowd excitedly waiting, the world's admiration, Harry Houdini won it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. At Scotland Yard they locked him in a cell, handcuffed and leg iron, thumb screwed as well. They said they'd be back in an hour or more, but he was free before they'd even reach the door. Oh, Harry Houdini, the handcuff king, he could escape from nearly anything. The world's admiration, Harry Houdini won it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. City, he was all the rage. He brought Jenny the elephant onto the stage, and he says, now Jenny, say goodbye to the crowd. She tossed her head and she trumpeted and bowed, but the audience said, ah, for heaven's sake, a disappearing elephant, give us a break. In the twinkling of an eye, their doubts he'd banished, for into thin air the elephant vanished. Locked and chained and buried alive, the audience afraid that he wouldn't survive. Whatever the risk, Houdini would run it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. Before he died, he said to his wife, I've been escaping from chains the whole of my life. But now the greatest challenge that's facing me is escaping from the chains of eternity. So his loving wife and friends most dear tried to make contact every year. But Harry Houdini on that distant shore, obeying the concept of natural law, never appeared, no, never no more. Locked and chained, Houdini the brave, seemingly unable to escape from the grave, his fame and renown forever at the summit, forever could be done, Houdini done it. Harry Houdini, the handcuffed king, he could escape from nearly anything. The world's admiration, Harry Houdini won it, for if it could be done, Houdini done it. If it could be done, Houdini done it. If it could be done, Houdini done it.
It's amazing how doing one song is far more unnerving than doing an entire show.
Andy, thank you very much indeed. Well, let's start with that song. Why did you write a song about Houdini?
Well, I read a lot about Houdini before I wrote it, and he seemed to be a really good man. And, of course, everybody does remember who Houdini was. I'm more likely sometimes to write songs about people that I think have faded into the background of history and should be revived. But Houdini, I don't think, really needed much. But I had a friend, a magician called Ben Williamson, who is a really great man. And he told me things about Houdini. And for instance, he told me that at a magician's conference once, Houdini was in the phone booth, ringing somebody up, and the phone booth had two handles. You know, the doors opened outwards, and somebody put a broomstick between the two and he couldn't get out. And
that must have happened to him a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he'd be angry at that or see the joke, but...
That's fantastic. Well, there's another verse for your song.
Huh?
That's another verse for
yes,
your song.
Yes, I should have done that. I might. Oh, thank you. I might look at it.
It's never too late to add. Last time we spoke, we talked about the fact, which is well known, that you began in England as a child actor. And I wonder how much of the actor remains. Because you said, I read a lovely quote that you said, because your mother was an actor too, and you said that she retired from the stage, but she never gave up acting. Have you?
Well, I'm not really aware of it, but it may be there. You know, I mean, in my show, I do tell a lot of stories, and they're much appreciated. I mean, I tell them because you can't go from one song to another without saying anything, unless you're kind of a rock band. And so sometimes I have a story to tell about before a song, and people really, they like it. You know, sometimes people come up to me after a show and say, really loved the stories you told between the songs. And I think, yeah, okay, yeah, but what about the song? I didn't like the songs? No. But so, that's good. And I'm pleased about that. And it may be that I got it from my mother, or might have got it from my early acting days.
But as a performer, when you are singing the songs, do you think you're singing them in a sense with an actor's technique?
No, I don't think so. No, when I'm deadly serious when I'm singing even a funny song, like, you know. And I think the one thing, if I had to do it all again, I think I would. I mean, what I'm playing is quite complicated, and I do have to look at my left hand.
Yeah,
but I would like to be more like that, you know? Like somebody like Christy Moore can do that because he's just playing three chords. Whoops, don't. But I can't do that. So there are moments where where the change in the chord is quite easy. And I'm able to go kind of look at the audience for 0.5 of a second.
I want to ask you about that later. But before we come on to your technical accomplishments, Irish music, if you were born in England and had this career, actually, as a child... and then you sort of switched to music. It suggests to me that you, as now one of the luminaries of Irish music, in fact, discovered Irish music as most people outside Ireland do. And I wonder what the attraction was in the first place. Do you remember?
Well, yes, it was an evolutionary thing that I... I went from playing classical guitar to... suddenly hearing Lonnie Donegan. And the Lonnie Donegan I heard was the Lonnie Donegan of about 5 years before, if you know what I mean. He made a couple of EPs that he'd made 5 years before, which I really liked. And so when I went to see Lonnie Donegan playing, I thought it was crap, like, you know, because he had...
So what had happened in the meantime? I mean, we think of Lonnie Donegan and Skiffle and him doing things like Rock Island Line. Is that the stuff you thought was crap, or is that the stuff that attracted you?
No, Rock Island Line was okay, but the two EPs were called Backstairs Session and Skiffle Session, and they were before he got well-known.
So when you went to hear him, he was doing My Old Man's
Dust
Man. Yeah,
they were really nice, yeah. But when I went to see him, he had a drummer and he had an electric guitar player, and he was singing "Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight?" You know, which wouldn't get a laugh even from this audience.
No. But that's not Irish music. That's American music.
Well, that's where I started.
Yeah.
I can remember. hearing Lonnie Donegan singing It Takes a Worried Man, which is hardly the height of musical brilliance, but I loved it. And after hearing it, I was on a railway station somewhere, and I was singing, It Takes a Worried Man to Sing a Worried Song, It Takes a Worried Man to Sing a Worried Song. And I was loving it, you know, and I was thinking, there's nobody here, I can sing it as loudly as I like. And then I noticed the station master looking at me from 100 yards away with the kind of, what the fuck is going on over there? So anyway, from there, it wasn't a big jump to discover Woody Guthrie. And that was my real, what's the biblical word you use for
epiphany.
Epiphany, yeah. Hmm. That was my epiphany, yeah.
Yeah. But your heart is not yet in Ireland.
No. It followed on from that to listening to Seamus Ennis's radio program as I roved out. And then I went to live in Ireland. And there I met all the people who I had never met in London. And they were all my age. They were all into the same kind of music I was into, and they were all into the same attitude to life that I was into. And I fell among thieves, and O'Donoghue's pub was the place where we stole into. Yeah.
And so, what was this attitude to life from a musical point of view?
Well, it became everything, because like many a child actor, I did not actually make it into the next stage. Like most people, when you use the word puberty, most people don't seem to remember what that was. But it was, for me, a big moment of discovery of how ugly one was and how totally untalented one was, and so I didn't make it into the juvenile era, which was what I should have done. And I gave up the stage in Dublin in 1962 or something like that. And I took to music as an alternative, and I was still playing Woody Guthrie, and then I began to gradually get into Irish music, and Sweeney's Men was a band that I was in with Johnny Marr.
And the fact that you were playing Woody Guthrie, but that you had had classical guitar lessons with Julian Bream, I wonder whether you were already playing at a different level from a guitar playing point of view to a lot of the people who sang Woody Guthrie songs.
Yeah, but the classical training didn't hinder my ability to play Woody Guthrie. And I copied him, you know. I spent my teenage years trying to play the guitar exactly the same as Woody. And he wasn't the world's greatest guitar player, but I liked his style. That was one of the things I liked about him. So I could play it. Eventually, I could play it really, really well. The Oklahoma accent was not 100% accurate, but I did things like I went to places where nobody knew me in England. And I pretended to be from Oklahoma. And when they said, what's your name? I'd say, my name's Woody. and there was one amazing moment where I was with these two boys. I didn't know them very well. We just met them. And they thought, wow, he's American. He's from Oklahoma. Amazing. So I was raised a little bit by what I was pretending to be. And a policeman came over. We weren't doing anything wrong, but we were out a little bit late, and a policeman came over, a plainclothes policeman, and said, "Who are you?" Like, where and they said where who they were, and they said, turned to me and said, "Who are you?" And I thought, "Oh God, am I going to, you know, if I said, well, actually, I'm my name is Andrew Irvine, and I live in London," my two friends would have gone kind of, "What?" So I decided to play the game, like, you know. And I said, "My name's Woody. I'm from Oklahoma," and he said, "Oh, okay." And I mean, he might have said, "Can we see your visa or anything or passport?" But he didn't. He said, "Right, okay." He said, "Boys, go home, go home." And I thought, "Oh, thank God, I got away with that." But the next Saturday, the people I was staying with in that area, the next Sunday, they had a kind of a bar in their house. And they had friends who came in, and there was the policeman, and he's and I was introduced to him, you know, and I'm going kind of, "Pleased to meet you," trying to hide my face, and he said, "Haven't we met somewhere before?" And I said, "No." So I got away with that as well, but it was a very close call.
Yes. You know, this is the music show on ABC Radio National. We're at the Gaelic Club in Sydney, and we're having a conversation with Andy Irvine in our Music Now and Then series. Andy, let's talk about the instruments that you play. Not so much the instruments themselves, but your approach to them, which is, well, it's virtuosic. You have been, you know, a really great player of the mandola, the bouzouki, the guitar, etc. And I wonder whether that technical accomplishment, where it fits in what you do, is it the grounding of your singing and songwriting? Is it the at the root of your musicianship, that technical accomplishment?
Well, first of all, I would never have considered myself to be a great virtuosic. Great word, that. I noted that word when you said it.
But you have to look at your left hand. You've said that.
Well, yes, but you see, the whole thing is, somebody who's a really good technician with their left hand, you wouldn't see it moving. And everybody says, "Wow, your left hand's kind of flashing all over the place." And that's because it's not very good. But I never tried to play beyond myself. And I was always more in... The thing was, it was like I was an only child. And I went... And I was very only in my early years at boarding school. So I really wanted to, I didn't really want to play with anybody else. I wanted to play me and Andy together, like, you know. So I did develop this ability to play an accompaniment that was quite difficult and was harmonically different to what I was singing. And I think that was the basis of what I tried to do. Yeah.
And the range of instruments, which kind of grew and grew, and with it, different sorts of musical influences, these all fed into your palette of technical ability, didn't they?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, the annoying thing is that I now travel with four instruments. Because some things sound better on this one, and some things sound better on that one, and they are they're tuned in the same relationship, so that if you can play one, you can play them all. But some are kind of higher, and some are lower, and I think that's good. The difference of sound that I use on a concert, I think that's good. Rather than playing the same thing on the same instrument all the time. But it does mean you have to carry around a lot of baggage. And And I'm not, and on planes, of course, you can't do that really, unless you're prepared to pay a lot of money. So I like to travel on the road, like, you know. Fortunately, as you know, I like traveling on the road.
Yes, you wrote a song about it. Maybe we could talk about, I mean, you said a moment ago that because you were at boarding school, you like to do things on your own. And you are, in fact, I think, and maybe this is why you need the four instruments, primarily a solo artist, in spite of all of the bands that you've been in and all of the collaborations that you've had. You keep coming back to you and your four instruments. Is this choice, or is it simply the way things have panned out? And is it, you know, is it your personality, do you think? Is it the boarding school?
Well, I think on the one hand, I really like playing solo, because you have more choice. Like, you know, I can change my set list from one day to the next. If I forget the words, I can play a bar of nothing till I remember them or something, you know. And but playing with a band can be very exciting too. Like, the one band that I don't often think of with regard to Australia is Mosaic, that was not just a great band, it was a really happy band. Mm. And every time I come to Australia, I think, geez, I must get on to the lads and see if they'd be free to come out here one time and do another tour. So that might happen. I'd love it. Yeah.
I remember a music show that we did in Brunswick Town Hall with Mosaic.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd all had a very big night. I don't think I'm being too indiscreet in saying this was early on a Saturday morning, and some of you hadn't slept, and yet the conversations were pretty good, and the performances were amazing. So yeah, I have happy memories of Mosaic too.
Yeah, good. Well, I'll try.
Yes,
yeah.
But let's go back. You mentioned Sweeney's Man. Let's go back to Planxty.
Yeah,
because Planxty, I think, is a kind of touchstone for Irish music, although it was relatively short-lived, like, you know, actually most of your bands. And I wonder whether you could take us back there and talk about how it came together and what you all thought you were doing.
Yes. Well, we all had our different approaches to music. And I don't remember there ever being a kind of problem about that, you know, like... I remember we rehearsed for 3 or 4 days in a hotel in O'Connell Street in Dublin, which is no longer there, and we were really excited to find kind of combinations like the harmonica and the pipes was a great sound, like, you know, so when we came to play the first gig on the Donovan tour at Easter 1972. We were kind of confident, but not overconfident. And we'd never seen so many lights, and we'd never seen huge speakers, and we'd never seen so many microphones. It was a bit daunting. And Donovan's brother-in-law was a sound man. And after Donovan's sound check, he did us for about 5 minutes, and then he went away, you know, and we played on. I mean, we were the support band, so... nobody was kind of concerned particularly. But we blew the place apart. And I couldn't believe it, because I was concentrating, you know, I'm kind of concentrating on playing the right notes and singing the right words. And there was suddenly a huge... You couldn't see because the audience was in the dark. And there was a lot of kind of noise going on. And I was convinced at the time, because I'd played in dance halls where there'd been fights, And I thought that there's a row going on there. But I looked across at the others, and they all had smiles like that, huge smiles. And it dawned on me gradually that we were going down, we were pulling the place apart, you know. And at the end of our half an hour or whatever we had been allotted, the audience went berserk. And we came off the stage giggling like schoolboys. And obviously we were going to have to do an encore. But our manager had to go and ask Donovan if it was okay that we do an encore because we were the support band. So we did that, and it happened the whole tour. There was a recording of the Cork gig, and after every number, the audience goes berserk, and all you can hear is four people on the stage giggling.
But Donovan must have been quaking in his shoes. He was going to go out and sing "Mellow Yellow."
Well, I'm not sure how he took it. He invited us to his place after that a good few times. So,
okay.
Yeah, no, he's a good man, Donovan.
The 1970s, was this a particularly important time in Irish music in Ireland, would you say?
Well, that's a difficult one. I've never been asked that before. But in the mid-60s, there had been what they called the ballad boom, which was largely a kind of... people who dressed up in waistcoats and played banjo, guitar and double bass, like the American coffee house type renewal. And in 1972, I'm not sure if... one can only imagine that the audience was actually looking for something new.
Because the Dubliners were up and running and the Clancy Brothers had been going for some time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Clancy Brothers were largely in America, although they were an influence on all of us too, you know. But, the Dubliners had their, you know, they were popular, but musically they weren't particularly...
No, and Planxty was particularly.
Yeah. So whatever it was, we were the right people in the right place at the right time, and yeah.
What was the attitude to the music itself, to the songs? Because you were singing traditional tunes and you were making up tunes as well, and you were also importing them from other countries. Was the idea that you would give yourselves repertory for the instruments that you had in your stage show, or were you actually doing something, you know... Did you think you were doing something from an excavation point of view on Irish music?
I don't think we ever thought about anything like that. I think we just we followed our own stars, which were in collusion a lot of the time. There were things like, for instance, you know, Christy singing the Raggle Taggle Gypsies and it going in, that little thing that Donal had done to make it go into Tour de Love, which was in a slightly different key. Mm. And I always thought it was slightly uncomfortable, but the audience loved it. So whenever, when we got to the end of the Raggle Taggle Gypsies, they went, yam-ba-dum-bam-bam-ba-dum. And then into the tune, they'd kind of stand up and roar.
So you knew you were onto something.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, what made, like, Donal was the first person to leave, which was a bit tragic, really. But I think one of the he never said this, but I think one of the things was that our set didn't change very rapidly. You know, we were. If you look at the sales of our records, you'll see that we were an instant success, and we hit the high point quite early in our career, and after that, we were actually going down. In Ireland, anyway, like in the continent, we played a lot. But when Donald left, Johnny Moynihan joined, an old friend from Sweeney's Man. And he wasn't really the same kind of musician as Donald had been. He was a touch player and not an engine room player. And we didn't get the engine room back until Paul Brady joined to replace Christie. And that was a great lift when Paul joined the band. Mm. But we were all tired. We were getting tired because it was a 24/7 job, you know?
Yes. What did Paul bring? Because, I mean, one of my favourite albums of this period, or any period, actually, is the one that you and Paul Brady did together. Right. What did he bring to Planxty, and what did you get from him?
A very strong engine room guitarist. He didn't have very many songs, but when we met him, he came back from America to join the band, and we met him in a pub in Donegal, and somehow we said, well, he had his guitar, and we said, well, sing us a song. And he sang Arthur McBride and the Sergeant, and we were all knocked out, as everybody was after that and still is.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was his big... That his big
was,
number.
That
in the
was
band.
His song. Yeah, that's right. Even Lakes of Pontchartrain is actually a version of Arthur McBride and the Sergeant.
Well, it came a little bit later. Though.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But it's just, but musically speaking, it's you could almost switch them. In 1980, WOMAD began. And I wonder whether we can broaden this conversation, because on the one hand, there is Irish music in Ireland, and then there is, because of the Irish diaspora, there's Irish music throughout the English-speaking world, and not just the English-speaking world, Scandinavia, Japan, Irish music is everywhere. And with WOMAD, you get a kind of strange kind of expansion in a way, don't you? Because suddenly it's kind of, Irish music is kind of absorbed by this movement which puts all folk music, all traditional music in one big, rather unhappy basket. And I wonder what you thought about that whole thing and whether, in fact, you thought there were points of contact to be explored, or whether it was simply a marketing ploy?
Well, I do remember when the phrase world music was invented, and I thought that was great because, you know, the word folk music was often with people who didn't know much about it was kind of I was never sure what they thought was folk music. If somebody said, what do you play, and said, I play folk music, and then oh folk music, and you wondered, what are they thinking? Are they thinking of the Clancy Brothers going hey? Or are they thinking of Ewan McCall with his hand over his ear? What is it that they're thinking?
Or Joni Mitchell. Could be Joni.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a vague
exactly,
term.
Yeah, it could be anything.
But world music's even bigger.
Yes, but I think maybe I enjoyed the phrase because I'd taken a few kind of Bulgarian things and played them, and so you know, I wasn't just kind of playing Irish music. I was
no, you arguably invented world music.
Well, not quite, but I did feel when people said world music, I thought, yes, okay, that's me, yeah. But it didn't go very far, did it?
Well, I don't know. I think why do you think that was?
I don't know. The phrases like that come and go, and it fit people like Dave Grisman and people like that. I mean, as you say, it was huge, and there was a lot of people in it who weren't anything to do with me at all.
No, or And there were various strands to world music, I think. One being the kind of exoticism thing of hearing something which was maybe quite authentic from Zambia or Sardinia, and which you'd never heard before and which seemed untouched by the rest of the world. And then there was this everybody getting together and sort of playing at the same time and throwing in their influences and giving it a big stir and ending up with something rather grey.
Yes, I agree with you completely. You mentioning like African countries, of course, that world music did open that up as well. So suddenly people who played the kora or even electric guitar and sang songs from their own area, that became a part of world music and became quite famous. These people, yeah.
Oh yeah, they did. Some
so
of them.
It was good. It opened the door to a lot of very interesting music from around the globe. All right.
I suppose I sometimes feel walking around a WOMAD site as though I'm being a bit of a cultural tourist, in a cultural supermarket, and you know, you think, all right, that's Japan ticked off, and now I'll go and get myself a bit of Tanzania. I don't quite like that feeling, I must say, and I don't quite like myself for feeling it. The other thing I wonder about folk music, and it's true, I think, of WOMAD, but it's also perhaps true of Irish music, is the tendency to romanticise. What you think about this? Whether in fact it doesn't matter at all. I mean, who doesn't like a bit of romanticization, or whether it perhaps is false? I mean, here we are in the Sydney Gaelic Club, and you must play in venues like this around the world. And I wonder who you play for, and how you approach them, and whether you're bringing a taste of the old country, or whether you are not thinking like that at all.
Not thinking like that at all. I'm just doing what I do. And what I do is satisfying myself, basically. You know, if I get something together and I really like it, I'll play it. I have a song, for instance, called One Midsummer's Day, which I really like. But some of the audience, it's a little bit kind of intellectual, I think. And some of the audience really think it's great, and others go kind of...
But you stick to your guns, I hope.
I do.
No, you've got to do that.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, it's... I've never been moved by fad or fashion or anything. I've always done what I wanted to do, and I've had a modicum of success. You know, I don't draw thousands, but I'm happy with the position I'm in with regard to the world of musicians. Sometimes touch of envy. But then I think, yeah, but you wouldn't be able to do that. So,
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm here at the Gaelic Club in Sydney with Andy Irvine for a conversation in our Music Now and Then series. I asked about Ireland and Irish music in Ireland in the 1970s. What about now, 50 years later? How have things changed?
Well, that they have changed. There's a lot of new bands in Ireland, new music. I have to admit that I haven't followed it very closely, and when I have heard it, I haven't been particularly impressed. I think that's all I can say about it. But it's popular.
But what are we talking about? Are we talking about pop music? Are we talking
about...
No,
we're talking about
folk
people
music,
who would be
traditional
on the
music?
Strand of folk music.
Okay,
yeah.
And, I mean, the other thing is that, I mean, obviously there have always been rebel songs, that there's been a political dimension to Irish music since God knows when. And I wonder whether that is something which has increased in the last 50 years, or whether it has levelled out?
I think it's levelled out. You know, I mean, there used to be, when you'd go to a Fla Kill in Ireland, you wouldn't hear many songs. The tune players would be well in advance of singers, and when somebody did sing, they would sing "We're All Off to Dublin in the Green, in the Green," or some Sean South of Gary Owen, some rebel song that one didn't. It wasn't. I mean, one didn't have a problem with the the content of the song. It just became kind of really boring to hear these songs over and over again. And I think that's gone now. I've written a few songs myself, which are not, you wouldn't call them rebel songs.
But no, your politics are much more international, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But I mean, I wrote a song about Michael Davitt, for instance, because I didn't feel that Michael Davitt had got as much praise or memory as he should have done, because he wasn't the kind of person who pushed himself. You know, it's amazing how you have to push yourself even in every walk of life. You have to do that to actually make people remember you. And so I wrote that song, and I'm really pleased I did. And yeah.
This is the opposite of writing a song about Harry Houdini, who everybody knows.
Well, all right. Yes.
No, but it is. I mean, you know, you say you should know this guy.
Yeah, but you should know Harry Houdini too. Like,
yes,
you know?
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of music now in Ireland, it probably starts with the Dubliners, actually, but I was going to say the Pogues, but there is still an important role for punk in Irish music, and that strikes me as mostly political. And it more recently has been joined by rap, which is also frequently political. Mm. And they're both, punk and rap, are in a sense folk musics in as much as they are very much the music of the people.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you think of those and whether they are things that can be folded back into traditional music, into the music that you play, and whether they should be.
Well, I think we're all strands of the same thing. I mean, the only people really who, in this day and age, who could be said to be really traditional musicians are the older people who play fiddles and flutes and whatever. That music is now probably played by more people in Ireland than ever before, and that's great. That's fantastic. That's brilliant. But the actual accompanied singing, which is outside the tradition for a kickoff, because singing was never accompanied in Irish music. That strand has never been as strong as the tune playing one, but I think the rap that I haven't heard that much of, but I did watch that film of Kneecap,
yeah,
which I thought was brilliant. I loved it, yeah, because it was humorous as well as being kind of gritty. Yeah, I suppose I should. I mean, before you interview me again, I'll listen to
it. Do your homework.
Yes, exactly.
Coming back to the traditional, the fiddlers that you're talking about, I mean, we're talking about, and it's health in Ireland, we're talking about sessions in pubs, in people's homes. We're not talking about concerts. We're not talking about gigs.
Yeah. Yeah, the session is a wonderful invention. You know, sessions happen in all over the country, all over, in fact, it happened everywhere in the world. And they are brilliant for bringing on, giving people the confidence to play, keeping the tunes alive. And I think they're really wonderful. But I was never a great session man myself because I kind of play quite quietly. And as soon as there are a few fiddles and accordions, I can't hear what I'm playing. If you can't hear what you're playing, you can't really play. And I remember a session in Spittal in County Galway, where I was trying to keep up with the people like Frankie Gavin, you know, and who were magnificent players. And eventually, after about an hour and a half, they said, Andy, would you sing us a song? And I thought, oh, okay, my chance. So I closed my eyes and I sang this song. And when I opened them at the end of it, there was nobody there. They were all up at the bar having a break. Yeah, so that was kind of...
But the session is also a way of keeping music or possibly putting back music in people's lives, day-to-day lives, that these people may be great fiddlers, but they have day jobs, you know, that they are part of the community who happen to be able to play the fiddle as a normal part of being alive.
Yeah.
And that's surely a big part of its significance.
Oh, I think so. That is traditional, like, yeah. Another memory I have is at the National Folk Festival in Canberra a few years ago. Donal Lunny decided to start a session with a fiddle player, I can't remember who it was, but the two of them started off, and gradually the people playing in the session grew out and out and out until there were the distance between Donal and the furthest player was probably about 15 or 20 metres, like, and there were kind of people with trombones. I mean, every kind of instrument was in there. And what was really amazing was you could still hear Donal Lunny.
He's a touchstone in a way, isn't he? I mean, I used that word earlier, but for Planxty, but Donal is kind of eminence Greece, literally.
Yeah,
Greece.
He's wonderful, right?
Yeah, yeah, and still going.
Well, just about. You know, he hasn't been too well the last couple of years, but. But hopefully he's reviving and
he'll be back here with Mosaic.
I hope, exactly, yeah. I have to inquire about that, yeah.
Andy Irvine, thank you very much indeed for this chat.
Thank you, Andrew. Always lovely to be on your show, and do have great respect for
it. And look, nobody went to the bar.
Yeah, there's nobody at the bar anyway. Yeah, so.
But maybe it's time we did. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I was talking to Andy Irvine at the Gaelic Club in Sydney. He's back home now, but it won't be long before he's back on the road because, as we've heard, he never tires of it. The music show was produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham. Technical production from Harvey O'Sullivan and Simon Branthwaite. The show was made on Gadigal and Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung country. And coming up on the show, rough sounds, peculiar intonation, and a raspy voice. It's Bob Dylan and how he uses his imperfections in his art.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.